Welcome to the Celesticon 2013 Designers Panel, or Designers Roundtable. I'm Craig Robertson. I'm going to be more or less a moderating, but I'm mostly going to rely on these guys to just say stuff. We'll be going for about an hour. We won't worry too much about timing unless people start going over, so I'll just start humming like they do in the Oscars, and hopefully that'll be enough of a hint. So anyways, we'll go around. We'll start with Jeff. Could you please introduce yourself and what your designs are or have been?
I'm actually the dog in this show. I'm a publisher of games. And as I told them I would start out with, August 17th, 1958 at 2:50 in the afternoon, what were you doing? I was buying my first board game. And so been in the business that long. One of the couple people in this room who knew Gary Gygax as a friend and a chum, and Dave Arneson and all that, and the late Clint Biggleston, people like that. So I said I would come down. They said, we'll put you in the design panel because you can critique design. So that's what I'm here to do.
Sure. Awesome. My name's Eric Bernhardt. I worked as a product manager for Chrome. It's an upcoming role-playing game, so I guess I'm kind of representing the new story game role-playing aspect.
I'm Craig Robertson. I actually just started in the design business besides being a GM for years. I got hired as the editor and developer for 1A Games, and we just did the Tide of Iron Stalingrad expansion. I'm also working on a couple of other projects such as Crosshairs, which is a new Euro-style board game that we're coming out with.
Cool. And my name is Brandon Roche, and I am an independent designer and getting ready to launch my first game, Dubious Alliance, a fantasy card trading game where you're orcs vying for the coolest adventure, you know, and ultimately probably not working well together as you pillage villages, rob gold, fight monsters, and ultimately stab each other in the back with the best intentions in mind.
Let's start with how we got started. What was it that we were doing before we got into the business? And then what did you take from those previous experiences that helped you in what you're doing now?
Brandon? Sure, I'll start. So really, I can't go as far back as Jeff with my credentials when I started gaming, but I started gaming pretty early. So grew up on Redbox and Second Edition and, you know, Car Wars, and you know, been gaming all my life. In my mundane world, I work in human resources for a Fortune 1000 company. And what I thought was an interesting, you know, I think one of the things that gaming brings to a lot of us is there's skills in there that we take for granted that we bring to our work world, right? And as a human resources person who often has to deal with conflict and emotion and rules, I've really snuck that into this particular game because it's a verbal kind of trade backstab game. So there's just enough rules that you can't outright break them, but there's a lot of room for error that I think is really kind of, you know, when I think about my background, my work world, and particularly working on a verbal type card game, was, I think, complemented by my work experience. And then my love of fantasy gaming. So grew up with so much fantasy gaming that it's so easy to sell orcs and rings of regeneration and who gets the bag of holding. The stuff we've all fought over, you know, for many decades. I think is the kinds of genre capturing information we all share. And I thought I would like to. So for me, it was an opportunity to say, I really like this stuff. I have an interesting mechanic. Let's see if a card game makes sense.
I actually am a credentialed English teacher, and when I heard that they were doing 1A Games, Chris Miller, the owner and founder of this convention, Celesticon, he mentioned that he was hired as sales for 1A Games with Dana Lombardi, who's also running the War College. I offered my services as an editor. And sure enough, they did need my services because we had a tight deadline on Stalingrad. So a couple of 3 a.m. phone calls later, I was originally hired as just for the project. Then later, right now I'm part-time, but a lot of the English skills and everything came into play. It's a lot like grading papers, only a lot cooler and sometimes better written than what middle school students turn in. So a lot of those skills transferred directly. So
I still work in technology primarily with systems and analysis. I was called in on Crone basically to tighten it up once the idea and the background had been created. And basically what my role was is going in and finding ways of streamlining the game that hadn't occurred to the designers, finding ways to make things that tend to drag in most role-playing games like combat or task resolution go a lot faster, get a lot faster into the action, and that sort of thing. So I think a lot of my technology background, looking for shortcuts, looking for ways to improve existing systems, really came into play with it.
After decades of collecting the games, and at one point my mother-in-law, bless her heart, said, "You know a lot about business and you know a lot about games." She bought me a company wholesaling Dungeons & Dragons and Avalon Hill. And it was I ran that up. In 3 years, we went from 70,000 in sales to 1 million.
Oh, wow.
And then in 1982, a man named Nolan Bushnell, here in Fremont, invented Pong. 18 months later, the arcades hit. The average consumer of Dungeons & Dragons, who was a 15-year-old and 13-month-old, male, began putting all that money he'd been spending on D&D, 25 cents a time, down the electronic rat hole, and more than half that industry contracted or went away. About that time, I was asked to form a company to seek to buy Strategy and Tactics magazine from TSR. That failed, but we had a company, so on we went, and now you couldn't spell professional, but here I are. As an editor, though, do you believe in the serial comic? For those who don't understand, a serial comic is, as you said, Tom, Bob, and George. Do you put a comma before the end?
Also known as the Oxford comma, right?
Yes.
Every single time.
Yeah.
That is, whether it's technically right or not, I do. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. On the other hand, when it comes to editing, I believe that once you know the rules, then it's safe to at least bend them. Which means that I'm stricter.
You want your players to bend the rules?
Okay. After they buy it, they may use it however they want. They can house rule the crud out of it. I'm okay with it as long as they're having fun. Okay, so that brings us to another topic. What audience, how are you considering the player when you're designing a game?
Good question.
So Jeff, we'll boomerang back.
My late wife, having 38 war game design rules to her editing credit, including Iron Tide, Panzers in the Ardennes, a game that Dana Lombardi owns. And the designer's original rules on that called for a 36-page rule book, and we published it with 12 pages of rules, and everything was covered. It's very succinct. The rules should tell you how to play the game, but not how to play it well. Learning how to win the game is something you have to do through practice. We see that, of course, in electronic gaming, where it's reset, restart, But when you maybe set up 1,800 counters, and it's taken you a week, and the rules better tell you every step of the way, because you can't say, "Oh, we forgot that one." And so we want the rules to be very, very clear. We want plain English. We don't use a lot of jargon kind of things, except for any jargon in the rules must be explained going in. The first time you say zone of control, ZOC. All right, that's what you're looking for thereafter. But we look for ease, clarity of English, short words, simple declarative sentences. Too many people write rules in the subjunctive rather than the "you do this, then you do that." "You might consider attempting to seek to essay to try." No, "you do this." Mm-hmm. That rules to tell you what to do.
Yeah, just to add to that, because my particular game, because it's a verbal card game, the rules fit on a single 8x11. And you have to have lots of ifs, thens, and there's a lot of creative language that's involved when you start thinking about rules for swapping, for stealing, for lying and cheating. And to make that fit into a one page, a single 8x11 double-sided printed sheet, what I totally agree. I think that you discover that being very directive, being very short and succinct and not necessarily stealing away some of the fun of the discovery of the game is, you know, for a lot of games, you know, what's a killer move, what's a fun, you know, do I want the magic shield and the sword and the magic sword more than I want the ring of regeneration?
Spear and magic helmet.
Exactly, which we have, a spear and magic helmet, so good combo. And I think that really from an editing standpoint, the discipline of focusing rules so that you understand the mechanics and not slow down the player from jumping in and playing and leaving a lot of discovery left is, it's a challenge to write for because you do want to explain and probably as the designer or somebody in, you kind of want to share all the cool stuff that you know is hidden in the game, and instead you have to be patient and know that your game will stand on its own legs when people play it and discover for themselves some cool moves.
I would definitely agree. I think the most important thing you can do in writing the rules is be very procedural about them and give very clear direction on how the game is supposed to be played. Another consideration, particularly for role-playing games, is you have to express intent as the designer, how the rules are intended to be used. There's some discussion, there's a debate you can have around, well, as long as the players are getting the right intent, you know, are the actual mechanical rules that important? And I personally believe that you need to both express the intent of the rules, why they were written, in addition to having the actual script procedures so that all the mechanics, all the design works as it was intended.
I think tone is also a factor. One of the things that I've discovered, especially in board games, is you have various types of people who are playing. So on the one hand, you have the people who just get together with a couple of friends and they're willing to roll a dice, odds or even. If I get odds, we'll just adjudicate the roll this way, and if we roll evens, then we'll do it the other way. But then you have the tournament players, which we want to eventually do some organized play, where it has to be exact, and you have to think, okay, I want it to be clear, I want it to be simple, but I want it to cover 99.9% of all situations. Now, there are going to be those times, and that's why tournaments have judges and organizers, but that's the trick, is finding that balance between a conversational tone and being readable. And there have been some RPG books in particular that have been readable in their own. I read Paranoia Second Edition cover to cover just because it was fun. Did the same thing with Over the Edge. But then there are other ones where I was like, oh my God, do I have to honestly read this whole binder? So there's a lot of balance there, and trying to get the widest possible audience and make everybody happy, that's the biggest challenge for me on
it. Yeah, and I think I think focusing your audience helps a lot. I think that's, you know, to stay true to your question, you know, having an idea of who's going to play your game and who you're writing to is important. You know, my game, just as an example, is focused on people that like fantasy genre, like a little bit of sassy, you know, we'll call it a beer and pretzel game, you know, a quick sit down. It's a filler because everybody didn't show up for game night. So the rules and the expectation and the person that you're writing to and the permission they'll give you to be a little funny or sarcastic versus a very complex war game where, you know, people want exacting, you need rules that are really detailed, and, you know, because you're trying to recreate something, right, with as much historical accuracy. Very different audience, very different expectation, and if you try to write a game for everybody, chances are good you didn't write a game to anybody.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Frank Chadwick, great game designer who is here but not in this meeting, once started a discussion saying, these rules were written by me and I'm human, so therefore they're not perfect. But that doesn't mean we didn't try. We published a couple years back a game that has a 3x4 foot map, 960 counters, 24-page rule booklet, 24-page player's handbook, and all that. And I know that the world's greatest developer, who I have, played that game over 100 times. And we had, at the end, one substantive graphic erratum. And of the 40-some more games I have published, because the rules are succinct and because we go through the rules very carefully, and because Jack Green will eventually criticize us, all the errata for those 40-some games will fit in 10-point type on two pieces of 8.5 by 11 paper, both sides. there's a legend out there in board wargaming about a second edition wargame that had a 24-page rule booklet and a 28-page errata. Do you know the game? No, but the second edition. It was they were going to put the errata in the rules and go for it, and they chose a new developer to do that, and he didn't.
I'm going to strive not to break that record.
Just trying to come in under it, huh?
Yeah. I'll be happy with that. Well, thing is, that happens. Mistakes happen. Stalingrad, we are very proud of what we accomplished. But even after the galley proofs and the factory sample, we looked at it a couple of days ago. Oops. I won't tell you where the mistake is. You'll have to find it for yourself. But it does happen. And there are always things that you look at and you say, oh, wow, I just came up with a really elegant way to do that. But this is what's printed. Okay, so how about the process? Where are you at in the process of your games, especially for Eric and Brandon? Where are you at in the process of your games? And what so far has been the most challenging part of getting games into production?
Sure. Right now, we just completed our first prototype pass that we were testing out here. And we're also currently in a phase of open beta online. So the complete game is available for download if any of you are interested. CroneRPG.com. Probably the most difficult part has been what I think we call in development as feature creep, which is that thing where I just want to add one more mechanic. I just want to add one more card. And kind of what my job has been is to say no, and also I need to cut this, this, and this, because there isn't room for it in the budget, or this doesn't actually contribute anything to the game. And that's really the argument a lot, is we want to add more, or we want to change things, or we want to move past certain things, but we really need to cut down, and we need to make as trim and as streamlined a game as possible.
Right. I like that production creep because I experienced it myself. You know, when you think about cards for just fantasy action adventure, there's just an unlimited number of magic items and monsters and, you know, good old-fashioned inner player turmoil that you can capture in a card. And, you know, for not only production purposes, but really so that the game becomes it becomes unplayable at some point when you put in so many features. That, there's a level of discipline, I think, that's required, because as you get passionate about your game, you just want to throw more on it, and having, I think, a more objective view of, you know, what's realistic, what makes the game playable, and still leave some for future releases and future information. So I just wanted to compliment you, and then maybe you can stop me from creating more cards, because, you know, there's no limit of magic potions out there that I can make cards for.
Exactly.
Save it for the expansion.
Clearly, you know, from a kind of where in the production process I am, because I'm independent doing this on my own, you know, working with a production company now, you know, kind of doing the social media, which I think is really different, I got to imagine, than what gaming, you know, 15, 20 years ago was like as far as getting the word and the buzz out.
20 years ago, there were 25,000 retail stores coast to coast, and the guy would see a flyer in his store, and it would say, "Bloody Bayonets is coming in August. Fred, I'll come in and buy a copy." And then Fred would call up his local wholesaler, and I would say, "Really good." And my assistant, who now owns Games of Berkeley, would call up Terry Canto at SPI and say, "Hey, we're going to buy so many." And SPI would amalgamate those 60-day orders, and they knew within pennies that was 40% for the print run would sell 40% off the top, and that would last them 2 years.
Wow.
That was you could take, they took that to the bank for a long time. And then eventually people would go down to the store and say, "Oh, Fred, that's wonderful. I'm going to go home and buy it at a discount online."
Right.
And later on, a game company I won't name, Bushwhack, the wholesale industry, which is, the comic book industry, got browbeaten into handling war games by a role-playing company that owned a board game company. And after that sort of switched out, the comic book distributors were still carrying lots of war games because it was giving them revenue. And their largest supplier cut them off. And so all the comic book distributors said, we don't need that empty shelf space, and this is too little for a product category. So the distribution of board war games went way down. Mm-hmm.
You know, and it so happens, in my non-gaming world, I work for a large retailer. And, you know, and what I can share with you is that what's been interesting to me is I'm struggling with this decision to even bother with selling in a retail store. Mm-hmm. Because the online potential, the e-commerce potential to sell direct to consumers, there's so many websites that are getting even better at it. I think gamers' habits are changing, where much that I love to go touch and feel the product, if the reviews are good and a lot of other gamers are giving it a thumbs up, you know, there's without naming any particular websites, there's some where I'll make my product purchase direct from the e-commerce, having never seen it, and generally I'm satisfied, you know, and just purely from a margin and distribution and shipping cost standpoint, going direct to consumer through e-commerce is on the one hand, and I have mixed feelings about it, I have to tell you, because on the one hand, now that I have a game and I'm seeing the potential financially to sell direct to consumer, I get it, and I get why that's advantageous. And then my heart, meanwhile, I grew up walking down with mom's money that I begged for hours to go to the game store, play something in the store, right? And with all that wasted space because they had tables that I could sit there and play. And it's a very difficult, you know, God bless those game stores that are out there. It's a difficult model to maintain when you start comparing the competition that e-com's bringing to it. And I see that even in other retailers that are not specific to gaming. So that's going to be, I think that's part of the challenge for all of us as we start thinking about whatever it is that you're going to release, is the retail space is just shifting, period.
Yeah.
And how do you do that, particularly if you're not going to do an electronic game, if you're going to do something that's physical?
Well, back to Creep, I have a product under design and development, and the developer said, you know, it would be nicer if we could make the hexes larger, because that way we would make the counters large enough people could see them. Mm-hmm. I said, okay. And it would be nicer if maybe instead of having to use counting out, we had like a plastic little thingy for like a range, you know. And the developer got all the components he wanted to put in this box. Mm-hmm. And I came back and said, that's wonderful, but we can't sell that. And he said, why? I said, because we'll have to retail it for $500 and no one will pay that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it, even in the six months that I've been working with my boss, Dana Lombardi, there are so many times when I've said, oh, you know what would be cool? Or, oh, man, we really need to do the Churchill. I need to see the Churchill in Tide of Iron. And he's like, oh, okay. Yeah, that's going to cost $4,000 for the mold. And then beyond that, oh, you want new map boards? That's another $4,000. And that's just up front. That's not actual production costs. Yeah. That's just design costs. And it's amazing to me the transition from guy with a cool idea to businessman who actually has to figure out a way to provide a product that is attractive and cool still, but doesn't drive you into instant bankruptcy. And I'm certainly not there yet. I have a fantastic mentor in Dana who's been around the block. But yeah, that was sort of a shock to me, is realizing, okay, this is why some games succeed, this is why other games don't, this is why some things get made and some things don't. There are tons of fantastic ideas out there that are either, number one, unfeasible in the form that the designers originally thought of it, or there's no market for it outside of like the five people that I might know who are like, oh, that's an awesome idea, but how many people are going to buy it? So that's been a big surprise for me.
You know, just to keep the discussion going, trying to, cause I really like this idea of the voice, you know, and who your audience is and how you're going to reach them. Because one of the things that I have enjoyed, even in my own struggles, is there's so many games out there, right? And even when I looked at a fantasy card trading game, you know, if I really am honest, I'm competing against, you know, hundreds of titles ultimately, right? Mm-hmm. Some indie, some well known. And how you distinguish your game, you know, really knowing your audience at a level where it's not just your five buddies that think it's cool, because I'm sure that there's other folks that you can share a really unique idea with, but how to broaden it at a level where, okay, you know, the genre has its own legs, right? Orcs and magic items and some backstabbing. Okay, I can get a group of people that might be into that. Or an RPG with a witch and hexy kind of feel, right? I think that that's important to somehow stay true to your story through the whole process. And, you know, and I think one of the challenges there that you brought up is production costs start to get in the way of even that vision. And in a way, from a positive standpoint, in a way, it helps you to focus and really be disciplined to your game, to your product, to say, you know what I'm standing for, I know who I'm talking to, I got an idea of what I need to capture, versus if I just spend more money, I could do all this cool stuff, and it never gets done, or it's too big when you're done.
Discipline is a really good word. Very, very good word to describe that process.
Just building off knowing your audience, I think that's usually kind of the best place to start, is to think, before you even go into the design phases, who isn't buying games right now? What's an untapped market? Who can I draw into this hobby that I enjoy so much? Because you kind of want to run a gamut in terms of experience, where, you know, you want to get people who have been doing this for, you know, since the 1950s, and you want to get teenagers and young adults and other people to play it as well. But you also, so you want to start, I think, with what group of people, what are their interests. I think companies like, can we mention specific companies?
We plugged our own companies, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay, as long as
we're not disparaging.
It more or less positive.
It's being recorded, okay. And it could be actionable.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
Don't put it out.
This is going to go out on social media, you know.
Yeah,
once it's on the internet, it's
on the internet. No, I'm
the
not going to
say, we'll know.
Yeah,
I'm not
just stay
say
away from
bad.
The TSA and Homeland Security.
Yeah,
should be
no,
fine.
Fight the power. For example, you see this a lot with, like, Fantasy Flight Games has, what's the word for it? Like Battlestar Galactica, they have other interests that kind of pull people into the game through licensing and stuff
right.
like that.
Branding.
So, yeah, and you want to look at what kind of what's popular in the zeitgeist and try and stay one step ahead of it as well.
I'm worried we've talked about discipline and branding.
Man, it's no fun.
There's a role playing.
Oh,
yeah.
Here we go. Yeah.
Great. Corporate raiders. Got it.
Yeah, I have no response to that.
Yeah. You know, maybe just building off the branding part of it, you know, I think you mentioned a great game for the record, Battlestar. What a wonderful game, right? And people line up to play it. And I think it's because we can connect. I mean, you love the shows, you love the if you not to age myself, because I'm still, you know, in the shadow of giants here, but I did watch the 70s version when I was young, right?
Yep.
And back then, if you missed an episode, that was it. There was no rewinding it, right? So you planned your family planned your evening around Battlestar Galactica, if you were lucky. And if you had cool parents. You know, finding a way to connect beyond just the mechanics of the game, because I think that's one way that you have to speak to particularly gamers, right? You have to have something unique, something that's different, or at least fits a genre they like, econ versus roleplay, etc. But I also think having some sort of brand, that pulls people in, you know, and that's, you know, visually we got orcs, and they'll be running around at 7 o'clock tonight playing on the raid. We'll have orcs on site, but, you know, just as an example, I think it's visual, people kind of get it,
right.
And then it for those of us with a fantasy gaming background, I'm like, okay, orcs, got it. I understand the universe.
Right.
You know, and I think maybe just, I think that's important, because when you look at a game like, just to plug your game for a second, like Tide of Irons, and, you know, when you see a World War II battle game, you kind of know what you're getting into, right? You expect some historical accuracy, but you also, you maybe want to be able to bend the war. Right? So the rules are not predestined at a level, right, where it's decided for you. But I think the important piece there is you want to relive the war, right? You're connected to it. We all have some stories there, you know, some interest in it.
Well, you want to relive it, but not too much.
Yeah, just enough that you understand the brand. You understand the war I'm going into. And I think another example of a game that does that, really, to really stick my neck out there and see what the internet does to me. You know, you look at the Star Wars franchise, right? We don't need to have the world explained to us, right?
Right.
We've grown up on it enough now to say, got it. Another alien race. You don't even have to explain it. I don't need a lot of entomology. I just need to know whether they got blasters or they're traitors, right? And, you know, I think that's important in that, just from a brand standpoint, if you understand the universe and you like it, that's your foot in the door. And from there, then it becomes the mechanics of the game and it's the playability.
One of the things that we're doing in terms of that, directly related to the whole Star Wars thing, we have a game called Crosshairs. Jesse LeBay, the guy who did the art on Morona's War, has actually come up with a game called Crosshairs for us. And I like to think of it as Watership Down with artillery and zombies. And it has amazing visual appeal. I mean, the guy hand-drew every piece of art, then went in, digitally colored it. And what I'm working with him now, since I'm the developer on the project, is I'm asking him, okay, Jesse, this is what I'd like you to do. I would like you to start thinking about the world and a narrative. Because eventually, if Crosshairs is as popular as we think it's going to be, because everybody who's demoed it just about has loved it, we want to continue featuring that world. So like GW does with, they have the RPG, they have the strategy games in a number of different levels, they have board games now. What we want to do is get a narrative going like they have. So if you know it's a Horus Heresy, you know what's going on here. If they're talking about the Black Crusade, things like that, you know what an orc is going to do from a one-sentence description. The Tau, the Eldar, all their different factions and races can be summed up in one sentence. So what I'm trying to do now with them is say, okay, let's give each different individual area, each individual group, a little bit of backstory, but make it so they're consistent, and so that eventually when we do strategy games and maybe an RPG, we're telling different, we're making different windows into a much larger story, like Lucasfilm and GW have done so successfully.
Yeah, I think that's, that brings up an important point in kind of the iconicness of like certain phrases and certain elements that are part of our culture that we can instantly glom onto. Like, you know, you have orcs. Everyone understands what an orc is. You know, they're kind of maybe a little sneaky and backstabbing. And, you know, you say, like, Watership Down, everyone has, you know, it's part of this milieu of, you know, Redwall and Mouseguard, and, you know, everyone has something to grab on there. And then, you know, just with my game with, like, witches, everyone knows what a witch is. Everyone knows, you know, they're women who use magic. And, you know, with war games, again, you know, we all know our shared history. We know generally what World War II is about. We know who the factions, who the players were, and that's something that makes it really easy, at least for me, to like pick up a game and get into it, is if I have that cultural touch point. And I think that's true for a lot of gamers.
But there's also a challenge there, because then you run the risk of, it's just another witch game, just another World War II game, just about another orc game. It's like, this is brand new. I played this 5 months ago.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge that I think all of us face in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's where, you know, I think that in addition to having a way to connect that audience with the story and the brand and the world, I think that's where the importance of the mechanic comes in.
Right.
If your game has something that's distinguishing and unique, that's different than another game, and, you know, and then I think you have a really good chance of, I got my foot in the door because I know what fantasy is and an orc is, and I'll try it. And then if there's something about the game that's unique or different, you'll play it again, right? You know, because and I think that's where that discovery that you were talking about, that both of you guys were talking about, Jeff and Craig, about, we don't tell you how to win the game or how to maximize it, but it's just enough now to say, okay, the mechanic was cool, I had a good time, let's try it again, maybe even show my friends.
Games are for fun.
Yeah. You know, one thing I wanted to talk about, because you both mentioned art as, I think, a component of a game. And, you know, I'd like to just talk about art for a minute, because in my, because mine's a card game, right? In this case, it's 158 unique images. So I had a lot of opportunity to go out and look at the art that's out there. And one thing that I think is kind of neat about the game world right now, and also a little challenging if you're going to be an independent game designer, is there's great art out there. I mean, there is just beautiful art. And I had to make an early decision, and luckily I was kind of, with my audience in mind, I made an early decision. I was not going to try to go to head-to-head with these games out there with beautiful four-color, you know, $3,000 an image, you know, portraits, right? Because that's what you're going to get into for some of those, you know, and we're not even getting into the background art yet, mm-hmm. right? Just a card face. And, you know, maybe just thinking about art and, you know, the production time and the building a storyboard around art is really important. You know, for my game, I intentionally wanted to have a module feel from the 80s, mm-hmm. you know, where everything's black and white, just like the D&D I grew up with, right? And so some of that was to simply control the art costs, mm-hmm. and some of that was to distinguish my game separately, because if I tried to go out there and go, you know, forward with this beautiful art out there, because I'm independent, that would have been a significant investment. And, you know, and still I think there's great art out there. Right. And, you know, one thing that I discovered working with, I had about 7 different artists that I was able to collaborate with. And what I discovered is if you have some concept, if you can just shape the world and what it looks like, you can really find artists that are reasonably priced. Mm-hmm. That can do wonderful work for you and can even work within a timetable and a budget. There's good websites out there right now for artists who are looking to pick up freelance work.
You need to find someone who channels Aubrey Beardsley.
Good, we'll have to go through there and see if we got even close. So the one thing I was trying to avoid is the Fiend Folio, the early versions, man, that was rough. So I couldn't really look at some of those pictures in there. They were too grainy. So
I don't know. I'm fond of the cartoons that they had in the first edition with the knight jumping into the wizard's arms with the rust monster. those still get a kick out of me.
You know, the wizard explaining as someone's trying to pick his pocket, he says, "I found out something to do with a bag of holding."
Just to kind of to build off what you were saying, kind of to keep costs down, one thing we did is we focused on icons on the actual card fronts themselves.
Okay.
To have, you know, kind of that iconic design where, you know, you can see, oh, this is some flame, this is a book with a sword through it, you know. But also, because we're a role-playing game, and role-playing game books really kind of sell on their production value, mm-hmm. we also went away with our character designs and focusing on, you know, maybe a little less iconic and a little more detailed and a little more expensive, but having that kind of added value to it, mm-hmm. As well, but also trading the bulk of the images we're using in that iconic black and white style that, you mm-hmm. know, that's really easy to identify, you know, during gameplay and mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Another thing I can say is keep your graphic designer happy.
Very true.
We work with Mark Schumann, and literally, I could take a photograph of a couple of boards. Let's see if I have one that's large enough to really be legible. But I could take a photograph of units on the board at home and then give him the text, and then boom. A day later, he's got this amazing-looking graphic done. He did the box covers, all this. This is pretty much just his graphic design, and he managed to match FFG's quality. Mm-hmm. Of course, they were very generous with digital files and everything, but there's artists, and they can be fantastic, but if you have an excellent graphic designer,
definitely
treat him well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or her, sorry not to be sexist, but mm-hmm. treat that person very, very well. We're lucky with Tide of Iron because it's one of the most well-documented wars that has ever occurred. So we can get away with just pulling archived photos for that.
Yeah.
But the risk is we're going to be relying on Mark to make them visually appealing rather than just, oh, it's a black and white photo. So any color, any eye-catching quality is going to have to be on the other elements of the card. So that's going to be a challenge.
You know, in addition, you have to discipline mm-hmm. your graphic designer, because anybody can make a half-inch game counter mm-hmm. that looks 8 inches square on a computer screen, and it's groovy. And then at 11 o'clock at night, under kitchen light, when you're trying to move,
yeah.
you know, it's like, for instance, game maps should be matte rather than glossy, because mm-hmm. they reflect, like that cover, reflect right. light at night, and we're old guys. The great story that they tell in Board Wargaming is the first edition of Labatai to Leipzig. The guy, they decided to use a forest green, a hunter green, for clear terrain. What they discovered was, since the Imperial French counters were a deep royal blue, this was the reflex. This is like you look at the American flag and turn and see in brown over there. Mm-hmm. The clear terrain was the reflex of the French counters, so after 20 minutes of looking at the board, you could not see the French counters because they disappeared. They literally, they were gone.
That sounds like a game concept waiting to happen right now.
But one of the things, one of our tests is that we take the components and we put them out at 11 o'clock at night, we look at them at the dining room table to make sure that there was a thing, not a decade ago, but shortly, some guy said, I've got these half-inch counters with tank silhouettes. They need historic camouflage. It's Mark Henkel in New England Simulations, and did a fine job. Guy came to me for Iron Tide, Panzers in the Ardennes, and he said, I want camouflage on the counters. I said, what does camouflage do? He says, it looks groovy. I said, no, camouflage makes things hard to see. The purpose of a counter is to be an information exchange medium. Mm-hmm.
Yes. One of my playtest notes for Crosshairs is the fact that the attractive looking movement dice is a dark blue on a seafoam green background. Guess what exact color is the water spaces on the board? I cannot tell you how many times I've been like, okay, where's the die? Where'd it go? So yes, that is going to be a change.
Bright red
the
with electric white.
Yeah, right. Yes. There you go.
Yeah, but it's just like there's a thing with half inch counters that has biplanes with World War I camouflage on them. And it's just, that's really,
And the other thing is, when you have art that tiny, it's nice looking, but you really can't appreciate it.
Well, it looks great.
On a reference card, say playing card size, looks fantastic. Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a good call because we have photo art for some of our images, and it looks it looks good. And then by the time you reduce it to a playing card size, that detail very quickly becomes distracting.
We had a game with 5/8-inch counters, and the guy said, why didn't you name the ships? And I said, well, Bonham Richard, Ticonderoga, and Saratoga 2 don't quite fit legibly.
Can we just put like dot, dot, dot on the side? Just to
and he said, that's why there's a glossary, because each counter is more than a bunch. That's what it said.
So, because I have this feeling there's different budgets, there's different production teams that are sitting here. And that in mind.
How much money?
Yeah.
You'd be surprised.
You know, I'd like to talk about
buying lunch. Right?
Yeah, really.
Yeah, right.
I don't know where I'm getting lunch.
What I bring it up for is because I think another thing that's unique for the game design crowd is the crowdfunding that's going on now. With Kickstarter and Indiegogo, and there's so many, I can't imagine how it got done, back in the day,
that's a whole other hour.
Yeah, just imagine sitting down with a bank officer and explaining. So there's these orcs, right? And they're gonna.
No. There are five phases of the philosophy of the funding of the war game, and for that hour, we do this next year. For that hour. It's just going to be me arm wrestling Dana Lombardi in front of the audience. I want that. I really want that.
I will talk to Dana when I see him. And Chris,
I met Dana in 76. So
okay.
This is.
No, it sounds like there's history.
Oh no, there's. Oh yeah. I knew Anne before. When she was. Before she and Dana were a couple. I didn't say it that way. The funding models have evolved considerably. Mm-hmm. And I get this because, by the way, wargaming is hereditary. Mm-hmm. My son was responsible for Candy Crush Saga.
Cool.
Big Fish Games. Wow. And he was with Toys by Bob, and he was head of quality assurance for Tony Hawk.
Oh, yeah.
And he got his start. literally, he got his start in 1978 at Origins. Met a bunch of war gamers. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm changing my son's diapers in my Origins." Oh, okay. You know, but he grew up. You know, it's like the little kids out here. You know, that's the future.
Yeah. Yep. Definitely.
I took my daughter to her first LARP last year at DunderCon, and by the end of the game, she was trying to take over Austria. So, proudest moment of my life.
She found the easy target.
Right. Get back to Kickstarter and funding and budgeting for a minute. I think a lot of what the challenge comes to, and I'm sure you can attest to this, is you have to spend money to make money, even in Kickstarter. You need to have something to show. You need to have you know, art, you need designs, you need play testing, and, you know, that ain't cheap.
Right.
And, you know, with Kickstarter, you know, there's no guarantee you're going to make it, so you kind of have to offset things. But there's creative ways you can do, you know, you can do advertisements, you know, on the cheap, Game Crafter, you know, cards, you know. There's companies that can do small print runs.
Yeah.
Do you mind if
Absolutely. No. Thanks. I'm glad somebody saw my flyer.
Why don't you have it tattooed on your head?
It might be the only one that got picked up. I'm not sure.
Yeah, well, I really like this. This really stood out to me. It looks like you just printed this off a printer, right? But this has everything, to me as a gamer, that I need to know about this game. I know it has cool art. It's got a whole description of what the game is, kind of boiled down to its base components. And even before, you know, I knew you were going to be on this panel, I was like, oh, I want to play this game, and I signed up for it.
Great, thank you.
So you can do something like this and still have it be eye-catching and draw people in. And especially online, running play tests, doing online advertising if you want to go that route. There's ways to do it that aren't... that don't take, you know, $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 budgets.
Yeah.
And speaking... Go ahead, Kickstarter is another hour in itself, too. And crowdfunding, because there's an art to it and a lot of work going into the thoughts, going into the process of, okay, we have our base set, we want to get this much, but now how do we convince somebody to spend $500 on something they won't see until 8 months from now?
Yeah.
How do we make this cool enough, besides the fact that they should just like us and give us money, but let's face it, it doesn't always work that way. And that's a conversation that I don't enjoy having with my wife, is telling her, honey, I need $140 for a bunch of miniatures that I won't see until early next year, some of which I will never, ever, 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 ever be able to get again. And I need it in 2 days. That is a conversation I do not enjoy having with my wife.
Yep.
So
say yes.
That's good. Then you have a good business partner.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, maybe you need someone to say
maybe
no.
Maybe we should hire her as the accounting department.
Yeah. You know what? I think as you, if you're designing something, you work on a project. One of the things that I discovered with the Kickstarter work is, you know, there is a lot of, you know, you really have to plan your margin and your expenses just right because, you know, once you really start putting your project together. And you start accounting for just shipping alone, right? Shipping is a significant expense, and you can only get away with so many electronic giveaways, right? I mean, there's, you know, please like me for a dollar. I think you can get a few of those. But, you know, most of gamers, they want a pre-release. They want to get something special in addition. And just shipping, and I use that one as an example because mine's a fairly low cost because we're talking about a card game, so it's not a huge box, and it's not as significant. But it cuts into the margin quickly, you know, because shipping costs are so high. So as you prepare for your crowdfunding, the money you're asking for, by the time you really do the math and figure out how much do I have to reinvest in paying the Kickstarter, setting up a good video, right, so that it's compelling, you know, it does mean that ultimately, as you talked about, Eric, I mean, you've got to put some money in there early and often in order to even get that. But I think if you have a great game, you know, and you're dispassionate with your money a little bit and let your play testers really talk you through it and make sure that your game stands on its own, then it's an investment you can get behind, right? Then you can feel pretty good.
Yeah. That's a lot of problem with Kickstarter is people will say, we've got the game, but if you put in another 27 Groznys, you get the collectible card. Oh, and if you add another, you get... Yeah, and they have not incrementalized out. the cost of doing that. And that's not just Kickstarter. That goes back to pick a company. You know, you have to understand what it costs to deliver a card. In looking at Kickstarter, I'm doing a philosophically a similar project. I'm the chair of my high school's reunion. And it's trying to get people, a year from now, we're all going to get together after a lifetime. There are 1,100 of us. Guys, here are the add-ons. Here's what
here's the ring.
No, here's the thing. Here's what it's going to cost, except that there's a set charge from the hotel. And it's going to cost less if there are more of us. And and then they said, what's it going to cost? I don't know. Yeah. But you're the chair. I said, well, it's next year. Yeah, well, I want is to send money. Give me a credit card.
So what? They're not interested in the class of 1965 collectible promo card?
64.
Sorry.
That was close.
Wow, yeah, that was
very
close.
Well done.
Yeah. Also not, the problem is they're saying, gee, you know, I'm on retirement. I'm living on Social Security. It's something you'll never have to do. No. There won't, Social Security.
It won't be there.
I'm not worried about that.
But we won't get into that political decision. But
you know,
the whole idea of life imitating art is that, here is the whole product. In this case, the reunion experience.
Yeah.
Okay, as opposed to the playing the Tide of Iron Stalingrad with Vasily Chuikov on cover, his good game, experience. Okay, and you have to know, what did each of these cost, and how many of them do we need to feed the bulldog, so that we can then have Dana take us over to lunch? You know, it's just that simple. And it's understanding what it costs, you know, most people lose. I was for 8 years and change. I ran a thing for the federal government in Oakland, California on sustainable business. And we spend $44 million a year. Most people lose control of the money between their ears.
Yeah.
And that's why companies go down.
Yeah. You know, I think I don't know if we're going to do a little question and answer.
Yeah, I think we should. Well, let's make this the last comment.
And we've got a world famous game designer in the audience.
Oh, yes, we do. Jack Green.
Hi, Jack.
You know, just to throw it out there, I think one of the things that's fun about this game design process for me is, I mean, just think about you are the artist, if not in charge of them. You're the designer. You're the writer and editor. You get to get involved in the shipping and the accounting. I mean, it's pretty all inclusive. So if you like that level of multiple personality, then the game designing is for you, right? Yeah. And when you think about being a one man band or a small operation that's not supported by a large team, I think from a timing and planning standpoint, and if you have a day job, so to speak, to fund this whole thing, it's a lot of work.
Real game designers have day jobs. That's a bumper sticker.
Got it.
Just like real game publishers have day jobs.
Fair enough.
Substitute teaching.
No, in fact, back a major war game publishing company published a role-playing game about being the publisher and running the company. Because that was a real-life role-playing game. You fail. You win. This was how they trained people to be product developers.
You know, that's a fun point. I don't know if you ever anybody watched TED Talks at all. You ever seen the TED Talk on gamification? That's totally worth watching. If you like TED Talk, there is a TED Talk. This lady who's out of the video game industry is talking about gamification and how she's applying it to really change the world. Wonderful TED Talk. I think it's, maybe just to hand off to the audience, one of the fun things about games and game designing in the gaming world is, we're in the best position to improve our planet and probably galaxy because we think that way. Where the average person may miss the opportunity, Cylons accepted. And what I think is...
And Dallas.
Perhaps. So... The whole game, I think the gamification and what you can do, if your product isn't necessarily for gamers and instead, like your publisher example, if it's a training moment, there's so much more you could do with with just the rules and concepts of gaming. That for me, that's kind of my back end. I'm on the training end side of it. I actually come out of the company training side. And it's like, well, heck, there's people that actually want to do this for fun as opposed to they were ordered there by their boss. And, so much more fun.
I'm actually in the game industry to earn buckets of money. This is the right industry. I'm in the right place, right?
You get the bumper sticker, apparently.
Remember, your boss, back in the day, when he first became a publisher, back with that first company, mm-hmm. he, like I, took the vow of poverty.
It's a cool disadvantage, though, really.
Okay, I really don't want to have that conversation.
With your wife. No. It's the vow of chastity you don't want to have with your wife.
Okay, not going there. Let's open this up to questions.
On that note.
On that happy.
All right. Hopefully they're not going to kick us out too soon. But
I'd like to say a couple things. One, Steve Peake, who was at Battle Line Lady Jacinto, coined the phrase that I'm president of the company and I'm also the janitor. So that concept is, mm-hmm. You wear all the hats.
Yeah.
And the other thing that struck me, and maybe I missed it at the very beginning, but I got to go to a couple other conventions this year, and back east, the thing that blew me away was there's a whole nother little revolution coming along in the gaming world of these downloads onto our smartphones.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a game on the Bulge out by Eric Lee Smith, who's SPI.
Yeah.
And while I was back there, Mark Herman was putting out a game on Gazala, and there was another company moving into the business. And I think that's going to be, obviously it's a small game, it's small action, but I think that's going to be, at least for wargaming, another little revolution.
That is actually something we're already working on with Crosshairs. Is we have a great, fantastic guy, Seth Crofton, who's been doing all these deals with digital designers to not only get our games ported onto apps, but translate their apps into playable games. So that is a new frontier that game companies can definitely, hopefully, exploit and profit from.
And the company that does Civilization is doing it with the World War I aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And the dilemma, you were talking about the amount of words that you can put on stuff, the dilemma the developer for that was talking about is he had 110 words for describing what a Fokker or a Albatross aircraft was. And now they said, well, we got to tighten it up more. You got to get it down to 85 words.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. It has two wings.
It's a plane.
It flies. It goes bang, bang. Kapow, kapow, kapow. That's good.
I'm sorry, you're going to have to cut out a couple of pals.
Yeah.
Without my calf pal. there's a cultural reference. Oh, for those of you in the room who do not know, that is Jack Green, world-famous, award-winning game designer, naval strategist, and published author, and a great human being.
By the way,
I don't need no introduction, but I did it anyway.
A selection of his books is on sale at the 1A Games booth today.
Yeah. Autographed.
There you go. Take
him to lunch.
That's what games used to look like.
Back in the day.
Like it.
Yeah. Want to know how to make the company fail? I always said, having quarterback, I got my MBA. This was my MBA, and it actually ended up helping me in the real world. Yeah. I learned a lot of not what to do.
We won't talk about the counters.
Mm-hmm. That too. Well, that one even got the artist's name, Roger McGowan, misspelled on the side of the box. I mean, I've only known the guy for, 50 years?
Well, not at that point. You'd only known him for, 4 months? So it's okay.
Well, it's like Dorian Gray. He gets older and older, but the game stays.
Question?
Yes, sir.
We were talking earlier about unique mechanics and how that's a way to distinguish your game if you've got something familiar. So if you have your unique mechanic set up, but you want to go about adding more meat to the game, do you want to go with stuff that's familiar, or do you want to add more uniqueness?
Yes. That's a good answer. Because you want to be able to describe your game accurately and interestingly in about one or two sentences. If you're spending more time than that describing what a game is about, then you need to trim or focus some. So for instance, with Crosshairs, it's bunnies with guns and zombies on a big adventure. That's it. Now, the mechanics are cool, the background is cool, but you only have a limited amount of time with each gamer.
Yeah.
So, yes, you want to have unique mechanics. You also want to have a compelling storyline.
Okay.
And you want to make it all mesh so that your mechanics and your storyline support each other rather than just trying to shoehorn some things together. Like, you might have a mechanic that doesn't work with the story that you're trying to tell, in which case you set either the mechanic or the storyline aside and wait to get the two things that might combine better.
You know, can I add, Craig,
Go ahead.
Another thing about mechanic that is important is, you know, depending on the kind of game you're designing, you have some latitude on what the players expect. You know, if you look at an economy game players love their mechanics. They, you know, these are people that want to math this thing to death, right? And if you're more of a rules lawyer, verbal gamer like me, you know, then I would say that if it's overly complex, if there's too many rules, sub-rules, and even a lot of unique mechanics, you know, at some point you can lose a certain audience and gain another. Yeah. And, you know, and maybe the difference is you look at the games that are on the Target shelf right now, and that buyer who's joined Target and is starting to put real games on the shelf is both awesome, and I'm jealous because that's the job, right?
Yeah.
Buying for Target.
Target's a friend.
I'm waiting for the...
A budget and a salary?
Yeah.
Yes!
So, you know, you look at some of the games that are up there, I mean, and they're starting to push them, like, I'll use Catan as a great example. Mm-hmm. There's just enough mechanic there that it... You know, you have to learn a few rules, but if it's overly complex, now think of, you know, you'll probably never see San Juan sitting on the shelf, which is a great game, because there's just enough mechanics that it's a different person that really wants to play an econ game. And so it's a balancing act. I think that's why your yes is right on. I mean, if it's too complex, you're writing an economy game and you might scare a lot of people away. It's hard to have that quick pitch.
Yep.
Once you get it really, really simple, if it's Candyland, on the other hand, you just got to know that you're selling the kids, and that's the intent. So.
Another thing is, your difference from anybody else's product is, here's a buzzword for you, it's your differentiator. You're differentiating your product. You're differentiating your product. Mm-hmm. And that's one of your buzzwords, because that's one of the storylines you want to follow when you play that I am the guy game internally.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. How is my game different? What is the differentiation? Mm-hmm. And how do I... be same enough that, well, like in my game, it's got a board. Okay, yeah, they've all got to have a board. You know? Yeah. It's like you buy a house under the wall, it's got to have a front door, otherwise it's not a house. But how is it different? You know, my company, our byline is, history is not merely what happened, it's what happened in the context of what might have happened. And so, you will not find Godzilla appearing at the Battle of Gazala. It sounds good, but it
everybody knows that was Mothra at Gazala.
Yeah, right.
Come
and
on.
Your facts straight.
I expect better of you, really.
I would also say that you should let your mechanics influence your lore and vice versa. So I'm sure you have mechanics, like, it'll come to you, you know, oh, this will be really great to represent this, and, you know, oh, I have this really cool idea, how can I represent it mechanically? So I think that kind of interplay between mechanics and lore or fluff is really important and can really lead to some cool new places.
And like,
it's important to really flesh out your world before you start delving into mechanics.
You can do both simultaneously.
I think
not the world, but a province.
And I think what Eric is... I think what Eric is describing is right on, because I think you do want the mechanic to influence your world, right? Because mine has a unique trade mechanic. The more greedy you get, the more the orcs start to pressure you to give something up, right?
Yeah.
Not unlike any other adventuring party, but we're going to pretend like orcs are somehow worse than humans, right? Or paladins. And so when you tell the story of your world, you want that mechanic to be reflected and woven in somehow. So they're concurrent, you know?
Yeah,
for sure.
And when you're doing world design, you can do the same thing. It's like, okay, this province, one sentence. This province, one sentence. You can also do placeholders and just say, here be dragons.
Yep.
Totally okay. You can leave blank spots on your map. It's your map. Mm-hmm. And you can say, okay, you know what? Eventually... I will want to do ninjas. Eventually, I will want to do bunnies riding
ninja
horses.
Bunnies. Mm-hmm.
Yes. So it's totally okay, because you're presenting one window with your game, and that window might encompass, say, Normandy, if it's a World War II game, but then again, there's all the other things happening there. Mm-hmm. The important thing to do, though, is make sure that your core mechanic is flexible enough that it can eventually handle those other things. So whether it makes it into the rules in the first release, make sure that you have a simple and robust enough system that if you know eventually you're going to add turretless self-propelled guns, that your system, at least you know in general how you're going to do it. You don't have to have all the stats for the Stug 3 yet, but you have to have an idea. So mechanic and world storyline sort of goes hand in hand, because your storyline is going to tell you what you want to do with the mechanics.
Well, I think sometimes it kind of depends on whether you know, about two approaches. One, you have a system, and then you adapt that system to a situation. Like, that's a really cool die roll mechanic. That would make a good economic game. Mm-hmm. Or you come up with the approach that, I want to do an economic game on this. What's a mechanic that I could use?
So, right. And both approaches are totally valid. And both approaches have led to great games. Another thing to think about, and I don't know if you guys have thought about it, is one of the things I learned from my boss, Dana, is the importance of expansion ability. Because, first of all, new art for a brand new concept is expensive. New plastic, new boards. Cards aren't quite as expensive, but I'm sure you guys are feeling the crunch. How do you take your assets and use them again? And this is what I learned from the business side of it. It's like, oh yeah, I want the Churchills, I want the Firefly. It's like, no, how about we use the M4A1 and just do a card saying that it's a Firefly instead? So thinking ahead, how you're going to take your elements and recycle may seem like an ugly word, but get the most out of them. Art, boards, components. That's a key consideration also.
Yeah, you know, that I like that point because, you know, there's so many games out there that are great, and it's the one game, right?
Yep.
And it's a great mechanic, and you own it, and you love it. And I can think of a lot of economy games, for example, that are just like that, you know. And some, on the other hand, the mechanic was repeated, and you see versions of a different economic situation. Mm-hmm. And if that's what you're going to build, that's great. You just have to understand that you've got one product at that point. Mm-hmm. And as a business model goes, one product isn't going to take you very far unless it's just Crocs and everybody has to wear the world's ugliest shoe for 10 years, right? On the other hand, if you're going to build something that's easy to expand or you have visions to expand it, you know, I think that it's totally worth doing, you know, and that's where card game is a great example. I'm holding back on the Ring of Wishes for a reason, right? And because everybody will fight for that. But the flip side is if it also invites that creep. I want to come back to that because you're holding back on stuff, and then pretty soon you're trying to if you don't have the ability to have a release schedule on a regular, particularly for an independent, and so you're going to wait for your income to ideally fund the next expansion or the next activity. Yeah. You know, there's a balancing act there that you have to manage. Yeah.
And that's where having everything laid out ahead of time comes in, because there you have less of a risk of creep, because instead of saying, okay, I have tanks and infantry in this box, and I have self-propelled guns and artillery in this box, if you've already thought about it, everything's going to be more seamless, and there's not going to be a creep, because you don't know if you might be working with a different developer, different playtest group, then all of a sudden it's like, where did that come from?
Yeah, good point. Just as a visual example, man, just real quick. You know, like when I made my card back, you know, initially I was looking for something that has a fantasy feel and, you know, that kind of looks, that looked archaic, right, to fit the fantasy. But then I started thinking if I'm, you know, and I've got that more on the front, on the actual card face. But the back I made fairly vanilla, so that if I wanted to go sci-fi, if I wanted to have a merge deck, if I wanted to just completely go a different direction, the card face, I can merge in other cards. And that was early on, I probably would have gone a different direction had I not really got some good advice on thinking ahead for the expansion or the playability with other, you know, with other genres, as an example.
Just to offer a slightly deferring opinion, I think especially when you're indie, it's important to keep in mind that you don't know what's going to hit, you know, and you can love your game, you can pour your heart into your game, but you need to be able to drown the baby sometimes and be like, okay, this didn't work. What can I do?
It was
next?
An evil baby, I'm sure.
You are so not babysitting.
That's a conversation he doesn't want to have with his wife.
Yeah. my point is that even if you love an idea, and you know, this is me from more the production side and less the design side, even if you have an idea that you love and you think other people are going to love, you need to be able to cut your losses and move on to the next idea, and maybe that one, you know, is going to be the one that sells, you know, 2 million copies, and then that one is the one you can really expand on and pull on things. I've heard from consolidators that it used to be and that the expansions would drive to the base game, and now it seems more like the base game, all the expansions do is like they kind of re-up the base game a little more. Mm-hmm. Like you're not drawing new people in with all the new expansions, at least in the RPG market. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I'm not in it anymore, so I wouldn't know.
Oh, okay.
Thanks to Nolan Bushnell.
Okay, we are at 1:15. We're already well over time. Nobody's pounding on the door, so I'm going to say thank you very much. Does anybody have a last question? All right.
It's down the hall to the right.
Great.
Thanks.
All right.
Great.
Cool. Thank you all very much.